Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on July 28, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Fena Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches emptiness in relation to the five clinging aggregates. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this Fena Sutta is a sutta on the five clinging aggregates. In the Arahant Sutta that I gave a talk on, I think it was this past Wednesday, in that sutta, in one paragraph, the Buddha describes that developing understanding of the five clinging aggregates in proper context defines you as an awakened human being. And this speaks directly to that. The five clinging aggregates are a central theme in the Buddhist teaching, and he uses the term to describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering born of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So you can see how it's all tied together as in context to dependent origination in the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha was staying with the Avosians on the banks of the Ganges River. He addressed those assembled. Friends, suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down the river, and a person with good eyesight saw it and clearly examined it. To them it would appear empty, void, without any substance. For what substance could there be in a glob of foam? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any form that is past, future, or present, any form that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without any substance. For what substance could there be in form that is constantly changing? So the first aggregate is form. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness, which is thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so this first aggregate that we self-identify with is a physical form. And in this description of how we identify with it, the Buddha is describing every way that we can conjure up a self, whether it's here and now, whether it's from the past, whether what we might be in the future, in mystical terms, where we might be in other realms or projecting in other parts of the universe. He's covering it all here, and he's saying all of those projections are rooted in ignorance of what's really occurring, which is that, in its most simplest terms, is that this form is impermanent. It's like foam on the ocean. There's nothing of substance there. Stop hanging on to it. Stop clinging to it as a way of defining yourself. And so what does that lead to the thought of, well, if this isn't me, what is this form? Well, this form is simply a reference point in the continuity of your own awakening process until you're there, of where you are. And so the Buddha's Dhamma unites the mind and the body with what's occurring. And so then we no longer see the form as a vehicle for self-establishment, but rather a vehicle for developing awakening. I got to be here in it. Why? Because it's constantly changing. And if I'm not within my body while it's constantly changing, what happened? I missed my entire life because I was here or there instead of being fully present with life as life occurring in this physical form. Is that clear to everyone? So the Buddha's not saying there's no such thing as a form. He's saying that clinging to a form as a physical self is a wrong view rooted in ignorance. And that relates to understanding what is occurring right now. What is occurring right now is the possibility to continue to incline my mind towards awakening and continue to become awakened. Clear? It's simple, isn't it? When you hear it that way. The Buddha continues, now suppose that in the rainy season, it is raining fat, heavy drops, and a water bubble appears and disappears on the water. A person with good eyesight sees this and clearly examines it. The water bubble would appear empty and without substance. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any feeling that is past, future, or present, any feeling that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance could there be in feelings that are constantly changing? Think of the liberation and understanding that I no longer have to insist that I feel any different than I'm feeling right now. No matter what the feeling might be. It could be sadness. It could be joy. It could be anger or anything. If we understand the impermanence of what's occurring right now, we won't insist to have less of it or more of it. It'll simply be an appropriate feeling and an appropriate following thought to what's occurring. That's called full human maturity. It's also known as awakening, as far as the Buddha describes awakening. The line here, and he uses it in reference to each aggregate, of appropriately seeing. What does it mean by appropriately? Well, the Buddha describes appropriately as having, seeing things from the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. That's an appropriate seeing. Excuse me. What is that? And so as you can see, as the Buddha progresses through describing each one of these aggregates as impermanent, and also to see them appropriately, which is that they are all impermanent. Think about how we do describe ourselves to ourselves through first self-identification as this physical form, and then by our feelings and our thoughts and our perceptions resulting from those feelings and thoughts, and then our fabrications. In this sense, you could say our hardened perceptions. And that how that feeds into a consciousness, an ongoing way of thinking that is rooted in ignorance. But yet we continue to describe ourselves, no matter how much difficulty or confusion we may be creating in our own minds and in our own lives because of that. But we continue to do it. We continue to miss the point that everything is in a constant process of becoming. And so why take anything personal? Because in the next breath, it's gone. And if we want to have meaning in the following breath, we must be present with this breath. This is why Shamatha Vipassana meditation, practice appropriately, works. Because it brings our mind and our body to what is occurring right now. On our meditation cushion, it's so important because then we can interrupt conditioned thinking. But as we take that conditioned thinking off our cushion and bring it into our moment-by-moment life, we can recognize the arising and passing away of the five clinging aggregates, the arising and passing away of what we insist is a self, and what the Buddha teaches and the Dhamma teaches is not a permanent self. Buddha continues, now suppose during the hot season, a mirage was shimmering. A person with good eyesight sees it and clearly examines it. The mirage would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance could there be in a mirage that is constantly changing? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any perception that is past, future, or present, any perception that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in perceptions that are constantly changing? So again, think about how your perception of anything, you know, pick any subject, and how that has changed over time in relation to how you feel about it or think about it or both, leading to that a change in perception. And it might be something as obvious as, just to use what's going around a lot, as politics, or it could be something as close as your own friends and associates. It could be as close as something that you eat. One day you like something, the next day you really don't care for it. You might form a perception. The reason why I'll tell a quick story about that. When I was about 10, 11, 12 years old, my mom brought home, you know, a big, probably 5 pounds worth of blueberries. And I ate every one of them. And I got sick for 2 days. Obviously, any young kid that's going to do that. And for years, I couldn't stand the sight of blueberries. Until, I think it was in my mid to late 20s, and I was married, and Joanne brought some blueberries home. And she says, what, are you crazy? And so I ate a blueberry. To this day, I'm eating blueberries again. But my perception was that blueberries are bad for me. They make me sick. And it wasn't until something happened, something mundane, that changed my perception. But yet, for all those years, I was holding it in mind. We do this with everything. Not as, you know, being averse to blueberries is probably not going to lead to continued misunderstandings in relation to the world. But holding on to views that are contrary to reality will. Including that this five clinging aggregate thing is permanent. The Buddha's reference, and he goes over it and over it in each aspect of this, past, future, present, internal, external, he's just describing all of the ways and all of the scenarios that we'll create in our own mind to ignore our own ignorance. And all of the ways that will create scenarios in our mind that take us out of our body in this moment. I'm here, I'm there, I'm in the past, I'm in the future, I'm internal, I'm external. All of it is in reaction to not wanting to be present with your life as your life occurs. And a lot of that flows from just simply misunderstanding of what's occurring. We don't know that we need to be present to have a life that is present. The Buddha continues, now suppose that a person with good eyesight is seeking heartwood. Heartwood, as the Buddha refers to it, is always relating to the heartwood of the Dhamma or the Eightfold Path. A person with good eyesight is seeking heartwood. In seeking heartwood, they went to a forest with a sharp axe. There they find a large banana tree. They cut it at the root and remove the top. They peel away the outer skin and fail to find even sapwood, to say nothing of finding heartwood. Having good eyesight, they clearly examine the banana tree, and the tree would appear empty, void, without substance, in regard to heartwood, for what substance or heartwood could there be in a banana tree? This is really wonderful how he relates this to Dhamma practice. In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any fabrications that are past, future, or present, any feeling that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, fabrications would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in fabrications that are constantly changing? Upon the Buddha's awakening, he awakened to dependent origination, which clearly states from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. That's what the Buddha's referring to here. From that initial ignorance, we are now separated from the heartwood, from the true nature of reality as taught through the Eightfold Path. And we are now rooted in fabrications. And from that initial step from ignorance to a mind now fabricating its existence, even though it's like foam on the water, the whole cascade of the 12 links ends in a confused and deluded mind prone to further confusion, delusion, and suffering. Is that clear? And so in that one paragraph, in this one sentence, the Buddha is pointing out how to awaken, recognize and abandon fabrications that are rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. How do we do it? We engage with the Eightfold Path.
Is he also talking about not having the right view and not following the right path?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you have to understand where the heartwood is, don't you? And so your fabrications, this is really the reason why he gave us an Eightfold Path. If a fabrication, we went through this a couple weeks ago, Tanisaro translated a particular sutta that relates to fabrications as perversions. Well, think of it that way, that we have perverted the view of reality as it really is. So we've created these thought constructs. And once we have attached ourselves to a thought construct, a belief system, we are compelled to defend it and create scenarios that acknowledge it, don't we? And so once we're on that path of causative links leading to confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering, something must be introduced to interrupt that way of thinking and recognize fabrications. That's why the path is here. To interrupt that initial process of ignorance leading to fabrications. The Eightfold Path interrupts it and allows us to develop understanding of Four Noble Truths. In other words, it inclines our minds towards reality and away from a life rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are. And the reference here again to these things, these aggregates, are like foam on the ocean or foam on the water or a magician's trick or a mirage, is simply to point out that there's no substance to them, even though we have developed a life around them and insist that that's who we are. There's nothing really there. And how do we experience that? Well, the Buddha says, ehepisiko, come and see for yourself. Don't take it on faith. Don't take it because some teacher's saying it or a Buddha's saying it. Don't even take it because now it's written down in a book called the Pali Canon, in the Sutta Pitaka, because that won't get you there. But if you develop this understanding directly, you will have the same experience of letting go of fabrications and developing that life that is free of any confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering that results from that. You'll be liberated. The Buddha continues. Now, suppose a magician were to display a magic trick and a person with good eyesight clearly sees the trick. The trick would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in a magic trick? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any consciousness that is past, future, or present. Any consciousness, remember, this is ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. It's not some grand cosmic consciousness that we should all aspire to. Any consciousness that is internal, external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, any consciousness would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in consciousness or ongoing thinking that is impermanent and rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths? Except it is this very consciousness, these thoughts that we are so enamored with, because there are thoughts. There are the thoughts that we're using to describe ourselves in relation to the world, to ourselves. Do you see the circular logic in that? That's exactly what the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta when he described his own awakening. How he got caught up in this feedback loop of wrong views, reaffirming those views based on the biased way that we're interpreting those experiences. Do you have a question?
Just in that, the consciousness that the Buddha is referring to there is also the sixth sense base, eye consciousness,
yes.
Ear consciousness, nose consciousness.
Every one of them, yeah. Yeah. Thank you for bringing that out. So that is, the Buddha teaches that each one of our senses has its own consciousness, eye consciousness, ear, etc., that feeds this ongoing thought-based consciousness, but all of them are rooted in ignorance. Thanks for it. It's such an important point. And so as we're using our senses now to interpret what's occurring, if that's feeding a consciousness that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all that can do is reaffirm that ignorance. Another way of simply saying the subtle and powerful strategies that we use to ignore our own ignorance. You could say that another way we do that is through five clinging aggregates.
Excuse me.
Which is really what the Buddha is teaching here. That we've created this form out of completely impermanent, temporary aggregates, or qualities, maybe is another word we can use. And yet we insist that it's permanent. And we cling to, referring to this last part of this, we cling to our interpretation of it as if it's us, despite this the confusion and suffering that it brings. Rather than recognizing that I'm stuck in wrong views, this is what the Buddha awakened to, rather than recognizing that my view of myself in relation to the world is rooted in ignorance, we insist that it's a right view. And once we have established that my view is a right view, there's no reason to let go of it, is there? We'll continue to defend it. And we'll create, this leads to Tuesday's class on the Upada Sutta, we'll create associations with like-thinking people to affirm the views that we're holding. And so now I'll talk just specifically about Dhamma practice or spiritual practice. So we will form associations that reaffirm whatever view we're holding, which makes it nearly impossible to now change the view, because, and this also relates to a lot of other teachings like the Kalama Sutta, because, well, all of my friends are thinking this way or acting this way or doing this. And now I'm not just talking about Dhamma practice, I'm talking about a lot of things that we get involved with. And that doesn't mean that if we're doing things as part of a group that it's unwholesome. What's most important is to recognize how it might affect our Dhamma practice, but also how attaching ourselves to our own ideology and then attaching that ideology to other people's ideology can create a terrific amount of conflict, whether it's just within our own minds, but potentially global, because of the need to defend that ideology. And again, I don't want to get into a big political speech. What is important to understand, even in that sense, is the impermanence of this ongoing consciousness that's at the root of any ideology that we might have. So you could say that the Buddha's teaching to let go of all of those types of views and simply be responsive in a mindful way to what's occurring. And think about how the world would be different if I was emperor of the world for 8 minutes and I could decree that everybody be that. That everybody simply be mindful of what's occurring and respond from the point of view of reality, of the Eightfold Path. There'd be no conflict left in the world. It would be the cessation of all conflict in the world. I'm not trying to establish the Buddha's teachings as salvific, though. The Buddha didn't intend it to be that way. Inherent in the world is stress. There is stress. Stress occurs because of a lack of understanding. And it's not very likely that the entire population is going to develop the Eightfold Path. But again, the Buddha never presented it that way. He presented it for any individual who was interested could, in this lifetime, in fact, fairly quickly, develop a life that is liberated from wrong views. The Buddha continues, seeing these five aggregates clearly, the well-instructed follower of the Dhamma grows disenchanted with form. That word is so appropriate. This is Tanisara's translation, and he uses that word disenchantment often, because, and it's such an appropriate word. Enchantment is a state of being almost mesmerized by what's occurring, isn't it? We are enchanted by it. It's not even, it's gone beyond a normal amount of attachment, and now I'm enchanted by this. So I'm enchanted with the form because it's me.
You're tricked by a trick. You're enchanted by a mirage.
Yep, and the word relates directly to this, doesn't it?
Such a great, the imagery throughout this is so great because it harkens back to other teachings and that imagery of a mirage, and then for him to use the word disenchanted, it just like works so well in the teaching of the aggregates.
Yeah, stop being enchanted with what you've created is really what it is. Stop being the magician. Recognize that you're playing a trick on yourself. But becoming enchanted with what, and again, taking it to its conclusion, becoming enchanted with something that's like foam on the ocean. The difficult aspect with looking at this, I think, is the form aggregate, because we are so identified with a physical body and we can't have a life without a physical body. The Buddha's not saying discount the physical body, but seeing it in reality and in relation to the other aggregates. So starting to define ourselves by feelings and thoughts and where they lead to, when those are obviously rooted in ignorance, when our very thoughts are rooted in impermanence, when our very thoughts are rooted in impermanence, then it becomes a simple matter to understand, why would I want to cling to anything that is so impermanent? There's nothing there. Why don't I let go of the conditioning, that's the nature of conditioned mind, let go of that conditioning thinking and how it has conditioned my experience of what's occurring, and let me see things fresh. Let me see things as they truly are occurring in this present moment, without the bias of wrong views, without the bias of needing to defend or continue to establish a permanent self when it simply can't be done. And then I'm free to be in this moment. I've liberated myself from my own wrong views. How? Through an Eightfold Path. And now I can live in peace and harmony and equanimity without the need for anything in this moment to be any different than it is. And then in each moment, as the Buddha taught in the Bhadakarata Sutta, I can think what I want to think when I want to think it. I can think and feel and respond appropriately to what's occurring rather than from a conditioned way of looking at the world. Again, imagine the peace that will be in an individual's life when we do this in the next few minutes, or on a planetary scale. They grow disenchanted with form. They grow disenchanted with feelings, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrications, and disenchanted with consciousness or thinking rooted in ignorance. We'll no longer continue to defend our own thoughts to ourselves because we realize that the thoughts are impermanent. They're like foam on the ocean. They have no other importance except that I conjured them up. But if we understand that we conjured these thoughts up in relation to a wrong view, we'll be eager to let go of them, won't we? So we can see what's real, what's occurring. They grow disenchanted with the five clinging aggregates. Disenchanted, they grow dispassionate. I no longer have a strong passion. Remember the fire discourse. I've lost the passion for self-referential views and attaching those views to things that are in themselves impermanent. As he teaches in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, if it's impermanent, it can't be me, can it? How could it be? It's gone already. How can I use that to describe myself? Rather than understand what an awakened, fully mature human being sees is a reference point to what's occurring without any attachment to past or future. That's probably the hardest point to make, because where's the self in that? The self is in a continual process of becoming. So the ultimate question becomes, what will you become? It's your choice. Do you want to become further ignorant, meaning continuing to follow those views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths? Or do you want to become awakened, fully mature? It's really the choice that each and every moment has. How do we make the choice? Well, first we need to develop a measure of concentration. That's why the Buddha taught the meditation method he taught. Because a mind that is constantly distracted can never be present in its life, can it? There'll always be distractions to the past or to the future, or to the underlying disappointment of the present moment, resulting in ambiguity to what's occurring in your life. It's still another distraction. But a well-concentrated mind, gaining the ability to frame things in right view, then can stay present with their own life as their life occurs. So the gift of the Dhamma, or the result of the Dhamma, is simply the ability to have your life and have it not be affected by wrong views on a continual basis. That's the Buddha uses the term to describe that as a mind resting in equanimity. What more could any human being want? And I use that word human being to make a point. We're not trying to be extraordinary human beings. We're not trying to be mystical human beings. We're not trying to establish ourselves here, there, or everywhere else, near or far, internal, external. We're simply trying to be what we are and have a human life that is based in the present moment, not in what we would like it to be. And that's its own reward. That's probably the better word than the gift of the Dhamma. The reward that we're all, everybody that is born, I always qualify this by saying, unless you're suffering from some type of psychosis, but I'm not saying that psychotic people can't get this. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to feel safe and secure. Everybody wants to feel loved. But we don't understand how to do it, because we start putting demands or fabrications on the world and the people around us, including ourselves, that the life must be different than it is. The Buddha said it can't be. Dukkha occurs. Birth is stressful. Sickness is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Not getting what is desired is stressful. Receiving what is undesired is stressful. He's describing human life, isn't he? So what he's saying is, as a consequence of having human life, there's going to be stress. There's going to be suffering. Learn radical acceptance and see it clearly. It's all impermanent. Don't join with your stress. The Buddha often describes that. Don't cling to your stress. And that's expressed, that joining with our stress through self-identification, is taught as five clinging aggregates. Because we cling these aggregates together to describe a self and cling to each and every one of them as if it's us. We compel ourselves to lives of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences because we don't understand the impermanent nature of all things. Let me finish this before it gets too late. Disenchanted, they grow dispassionate. Through dispassion, they are released. With release, there is the knowledge that they are released. It's such an important line. With the understanding we're released, we know that we're released. Ehipasiko, come and see for yourself. It's not something that we take on faith. It's not something that I'm doing enough bowing and enough chanting and I'm meditating long enough that I know at some point I'll be delivered. Well, the Buddha never taught anything. That's a salvific teaching, isn't it? The Buddha taught to do these things and you'll know for yourself their efficacy and their the efficient way in which they bring awakening. They know that birth is ended. The fully integrated life has been lived. I use that term, fully integrated, where translations almost always say holy. The holy life has been lived. And the only, I don't have any aversion to a holy life. In fact, I think this is a holy life. It's the usual meaning between holy as religious. The term simply means a life that is well integrated in a holistic way with the Eightfold Path. So I think a clear term is fully integrated life has been lived. The path is complete. They know there will be no more moments rooted in ignorance. Points right back to what the Buddha awakened to, doesn't it? No more moments rooted in ignorance that would give rise to fabrications. And all of that, despite the seemingly permanent and substantial nature of ignorance, of suffering rooted in ignorance, it's like foam on the ocean. And how do we experience it? Change the way we think. We go from wrong view to right view. How do we do that? Through the Eightfold Path. For the Buddha continues, form is like a glob of foam, feeling a bubble, perception a mirage, fabrications a banana tree. Consciousness is a magician's trick. When you observe them appropriately, examine them appropriately, it is clear they are empty, void, and without substance. To anyone who sees them clearly, they are empty of ignorance. That's the essence of the Buddha's teaching, to develop emptiness of ignorance. What does that mean? It means now where there was once ignorance, I am empty of that, wisdom prevails. I understand things as they really are. Beginning with the body, when seen with profound discernment, as taught by the Buddha, form is rejected. It is cast aside. When bereft of wrong views, the emptiness of form is seen clearly like a magic trick. And again, this points to the Buddha's use of the term emptiness and what it means. It's not some amorphous void that we're to aspire to or to establish ourselves in, which is a lot of what some other teachings teach. It's simply a practical explanation of being empty of something. In this sense, being emptiness of form or clinging to form. The emptiness of form is seen clearly like a magic trick, an idiot's babbling. No substance is found here. A well-informed Dhamma practitioner, their persistence aroused, should continually view the aggregates, mindful and alert. They should discard greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, and make themselves their own refuge, and take to the Dhamma as if their head was on fire, in hopes of gaining Nibbana. Nibbana is awakening or full human maturity. The literal translation of Nibbana is extinguished, meaning that we've had extinguished the fires of passion rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's today's talk. Thank you. I hope you found it useful. any questions directly on a thought, and then we'll go around on a thought. On the sutta?
I have a question with this in terms of today's world and, so living each moment as it occurs makes a lot of sense, but in today's world, I feel like I need to take steps to make sure that there is a world.
Hmm. Meaning that it is in such dire straits that as individuals. And there's that can be done within the framework of the Eightfold Path, because we've lost fabrications, which in this case would be putting expectations on something. So someone who is mindful and alert, who is well concentrated, would certainly see within their environment things that they should support and things that they should not support, simply because they fall within the framework of right speech, right action, right livelihood, don't they? There's clear guidelines. And then as an individual, it's up to us to decide what is appropriate action within that framework to take. So it, developing full human maturity, now I'm not saying this is what you're inferring, but many people will infer that it leads to simple passivity, that you don't do anything. When the opposite is really true. Your efforts are based in reality and they're expressed in ways that have a potential to actually do some good. So one aspect of right speech and right action is to understand if your words or your deeds are, one, appropriate, meaning they are harmless in every way, but even more important, are they necessary and are they likely to be taken in the way that they are meant? In other words, are they going to fall on deaf ears or even maybe create more resistance to who you might be conversing with or not? And those are simple guidelines that any of us can undertake. It's a really a profound question, Mary, though, because there are the difficulties in the world today seem much more immediate, and it seems like we're much closer to the edge than we've ever been. But the truth of the matter is that the difficulties that we have today are the same difficulties that we've been having in my lifetime, but they're also, in a very real way, the same difficulties that the Buddha awakened to and acknowledged during his lifetime. So let me explain that a little bit. I remember walking out, and this is one of those memories I'll never forget. I remember walking home from school, so it must have been first or second grade, 6, 7, maybe 8 years old, and the air raids went off. And we were taught that when you hear that siren, you seek shelter immediately. And I remember being about, my walk home was about a mile from school, being terrified and going banging on the nearest door that I could find, screaming to let me into their basement because the bombs are coming. This is the world, and I was young, you know, everybody that's my age grew up in that. We grew up, we used to have air raid drills in school. If you were old enough, you remember that. And we were taught, either you go under your desk, sometimes they would take us to another part of the school. But that's how I grew up. The immediacy of nuclear annihilation was present then, you know, 55 years ago as it is now. That's not to say that it's not something we should be concerned about. But it's also described in the First Noble Truth as dukkha occurs. And it's rooted in what the Second Noble Truth describes as craving originates and clinging perpetuates that suffering. So the greed in the world and the aversion in the world is what has led to what's occurring. If I'm really concerned about what's occurring in the world, the most appropriate thing that I can do is to take to the Dhamma and fully awaken and start seeing the world from right view. Why is that so important? Because then I can start expressing myself from that view. The Buddha did nothing for anybody else. This is just simply what occurred until he awakened. And upon his awakening, he then taught everyone how to bring peace in their mind and in their environment. He taught everyone in that time during northern India, there was a caste system much like today. He didn't exclude anyone. He taught the lowest untouchable to the most powerful ruler of his time, his Dhamma. And in so doing, he affected greatly the overall peace and societal stability of his time. And I would say that in some ways he's still having that influence, but not in a great way. Sorry for the long answer to your question, but it was such an important question. Does that help your understanding? Yeah, it really is a concern that I think any rational human being would have today. And then when you start taking up the Dhamma and realize its implications, it could be really an underlying, well, what happens? What do I do with all these concerns once I put aside all of that things that I'm clinging to? But remember, what we're clinging to is like foam on the ocean. An awakened human being would likely see the difficulties and the polarization that's caused by taking stances on these difficulties completely different. And that doesn't mean that you will dismiss them, but you'll understand them in a different light. So when I was young and ideological, at least much more ideological than I am today, and I think about this not often but occasionally, that I do see things differently than I would have at 20 or 25 or even 30. And I'm not leading to say that because I'm seeing it differently, that today's view is a right view, but I see my view today more in accordance with the Eightfold Path. And so there's things in the world that greatly disturb me, but I no longer need them to be any different than they are. And that changes my internal response and my external response greatly. So for what that's worth. Any other questions before we go around the room? Thank you, Mary. It was really a great, great question. Matt, good to see you today.
John, good to see you too. Thanks for sharing this sutta. Good to see my friends and Sangha members. I don't have much to add, just that I really enjoy sitting here and hearing the teachings.
You too. I'm glad you're here this morning. David, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you, Jim. This is a practice not to dabble in.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I imagine that if you jump in and jump out and dabble and pick and choose what you're doing, it could bring more suffering.
Mm-hmm. It could.
And with full, joyful, energetic engagement, can look at the troubles of the world within the framework of the Eightfold Path, and those are the guardrails. Like, I can care about what's happening in Bosnia 10 years ago, or when I was 8 years old hearing body counts. You know, today I can see things within that, the Four Noble Truths, and that brings relief, because it's a good guiding way to live.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, it simply brings understanding of why dukkha occurs in the world, doesn't it? We can understand it now, and since we can understand it, we don't have any more aversion to it. It kind of relates to Mary's question too. But it doesn't mean we don't recognize it. It doesn't mean that we don't do what we can about it. But we maintain a peaceful and calm mind no matter what's occurring. Thank you. Becky, good to see you.
Good to be here. I really appreciated listening to this sutta today. Since February, I've been going through a difficult so hard to respond to each thing that happens as it happens, and not try to plan or not project a response. And yesterday I had already responded to one very difficult piece of this, and it's a response that I feel, I don't know if it's my ego responding or if I'm seeing things clearly, like you just explained to Mary. In fact, your explanation to Mary was extremely helpful for me. So I don't know if my response is ego or if I'm seeing things clearly. But I do know that responding in a way that people are trying to get me to respond makes me feel terrible. It makes me feel like situation worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, I feel like I was kind of not attacked, but almost by one of the parties that's involved, one of the lawyers actually. And I stuck to my guns yesterday. You know, I've already told him in writing that I'm not going to do what he wants me to do. And he's still trying to get me to do this. And I told him again I wasn't going to do it. But I have just agonized over that decision, because mainly because I'm not really sure I'm seeing it clearly. You know, I'm not sure. I mean, this has to do with my family, so it goes back, you know. Five, 70 years, and so this was helpful. What it did do for me is, what I did realize is that some of my decisions that I've been agonizing over to be more proactive in this process are rooted in ignorance and are my ego, because I'm trying to force an outcome that I am really clinging to.
Mm.
So I backed off of, I mean, today in listening to this, I realized that that is not helpful. But just responding to this one thing has just been so difficult. But I just have to try to get a clearer view. And
mm-hmm.
I've talked to other members of my immediate family. They think that my response is seeing a clear picture. So that's all I have to say about that.
Thank you, Becky. It's as we're developing the Eightfold Path, there's always or likely going to be some confusion as to whether acting in accordance with the path and or not. But the tension that you describe is a good way of knowing that you might be on the outside the path.
Uh-huh.
But the importance of that is what you described. At least you recognize it.
Right.
That's really the that will continue to guide you. The great liberation that comes from integrating the Eightfold Path is in knowing that in thought, word, and deed, as long as I am acting in accordance with this framework, there's nothing else that I can do. And so I explained right speech and right action, that you know, it's not just being honest, there's more to it. But once we've done that, once we've done what we can in any situation, we let go of the results, because we have no control over other people. You know, one of the things that we can fall into, and I did, you know, when I first started, I wouldn't even say when I started studying what the Buddha taught, but just becoming more spiritual, because I was becoming this most wonderful spiritual person that the whole world needed to change and be as wonderful as me. It doesn't work that way. And so the subtlety of that could be that now that I understand the Eightfold Path, the whole world has to fit into that. Well, that's just the opposite of understanding, isn't it? We understand from our own point of view reality, but we also understand that most of the world is rooted and acting in views that are rooted in ignorance of the way things really are. So greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking follows from that. It's just to be expected. You know? A simpler way of putting it is that other people are often part of dukkha. They just are. That's not that they're bad or stupid or generally ignorant. It simply means that they're operating from a conditioned way of living in the world too.
Mm-hmm.
We're the fortunate ones. We know it, and we can do something about it. But you know, So thank you for sharing that. It's very personal.
Helpful.
Thank you. Helpful to the whole Sangha for you bringing it up. Mary, good to see you, and thank you again for that question. Thank you. The I don't. I was the difficulties in the United States, the extreme polarizing views. When you see them from the point of view of this right view, wrong view, and where that leads us to, it's easy to understand where these extreme views come from, and where people feel no matter what that they're always right. And again, I'm not just talking about one individual, I'm talking about people and seem to be on both sides. Rather than understanding what the Buddha taught as a middle way, which brings an understanding to, you know, the middle way is not just, I'm not just talking about a middle way between polarizing views, except I am exactly talking about that, because it brings us an understanding of the nature of suffering. Simply as a consequence of being involved in a human life, being on this planet, there's going to be dukkha. There's going to be disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences. When we relieve ourselves of the need for those things to be any different, we're simply much more at peace with what's occurring, and we're more able to take action that is likely to have a positive benefit on the world rather than create more conflict. It's so important. What a great class. Any other questions or comments? Okay, we'll finish with the usual Metta Sutta. We'll talk about it. We're going to have something to do with the Rare and Learning Cooperative, but we'll decide that this week, and I'll announce it next week. And our retreat's coming up. Anybody wants to go? There's still plenty of room. We'll finish. The retreat's September 20th to the 23rd. Info on the website. We'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So again, find a relaxed meditative posture, and become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. peace.